Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS-LP, Cal's Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm, bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cal's Community Radio thanks Mini Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Mini Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Mini Rivers carries fine loose leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Mini Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. You can phone them at 707-829-8871 or visit them on the web at www.miniriversbooks.com. Cal's Community Radio thanks Gay Jacobson at Bodega Bay Massage for her support. Gay has been a massage therapist in West County since 1981. She offers a deeply relaxing therapeutic massage while realigning the body for maximum circulation through the joints. Body scrubs are also offered. Gay has offices in three locations, Bodega Bay, Bodega, and Sebastopol. And you can make an appointment by calling 707-876-3174. Additional information can be found online at bodegabaymassage.com. Cal's Community Radio is membership supported. Everyone who works at the station does so on a volunteer basis, but we have operating costs to keep the station on the air, and we have some ambitious projects to increase our listenership in the Sebastopol area by relocating our antenna. And in fact, there's a very practical way that you can help celebrate and support Cal's in this project. We have the More Cowbells Ball, which is happening Sunday, May 3rd. This is going to be a musical event. We ask a $25 donation, and the purpose is to support Cal's Radio, support our antenna relocation campaign, and to support community radio and free speech. This is going to be at Hop Monk in Sebastopol. So that's May 3rd, the More Cowbells Ball. There'll be musicians such as Dylan Chambers, the Ricky Ray Band, Stylites on stage, Julie Larson, Captain Paisley. So it's going to be a great event, and that's a great way for you to have fun and enjoy the music that we produce, enjoy the shows that we produce, and to support our move to Sebastopol.
Move on over to that fundraiser.
You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I will be speaking with our guest by telephone, Michaela Cordio, PhD, author of Live in Love, A Life Handbook for the New Golden Age.
I think that would be Live in Love.
Live in Love, yes. It could be Live in Love, too. Her life has been a varied journey, including a devout Catholic upbringing, later a career in science. After a midlife crisis, Michaela gave up her previous career. Today she describes herself as a mystic, a channel for the ascended hosts of light, a messenger for Mother, Father, God, an author, a spiritual traveler, an ascension teacher, and as a healer, both personal and planetary, a mother and a grandmother.
We'll get started with that conversation after a short musical break. You'll be listening to The Humours of Scarif, a traditional Irish piece from the CD The Celtic Viol, an homage to the Irish and Scottish musical traditions, for which music is performed by Jordi Savall on treble viols and Andrew Lawrence King on Irish harp and psalterium.
Thank you.
This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Rob Schmidt, director of Tayu Meditation Center, and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol.
Great to be here on All Fool's Day in Occidental.
Our guest today by telephone is Michaela Cordio, Ph.D., author of Live and Love, A Life Handbook for the New Golden Age. Her search for a direct experience of God began with her devout Catholic upbringing. She went on to become, in her own words, an overachiever in a career in science. As a result of a midlife crisis, she was introduced to basic energy tools and guided visualizations and the capacity to see, hear, and feel light. Michaela had found her life's work and gave up her previous career. Today she describes herself as a mystic, a channel for the ascended hosts of light, a messenger for Mother, Father, God, an author, a spiritual traveler, an ascension teacher, as a healer, both personal and planetary, mother and grandmother. So, Michaela Cordio, welcome to The Mystical Positivist. Sorry.
That's quite the list you got out there.
Yeah, we're definitely hearing a bit of a buzz, so you might try this without the headphones that you were describing
earlier. Okay, why don't I do that? Hold on.
That's much better from our end of things.
Well, we want everybody to be able to hear well. So.
Yeah. There was a distinct buzz before. So let me get started. You know, we always begin these interviews by asking people about their spiritual and religious backgrounds, and we like to begin at the beginning with first impressions of. What we, you know, in retrospect would point to as being spiritual or religious. I know, Stuart read in the biographical material he was reading earlier that you had a devoutly Catholic, Roman Catholic upbringing, but I'm wondering if there were any other early influences in your life, moments which on reflection you can... in retrospect, identify as leading in the direction that your life's work took later?
Well, good question. There were a couple of moments that, looking back, it was like, oh, that's what that was. But the Catholic upbringing was pretty much the main focus. I was, my mother was a very devoted Catholic. She was Italian and all that goes with that, and we were pretty strict on the rules and the Fridays and all that stuff. And
where were you growing up?
I grew up, I was in northern Indiana until I was 9 and a half, and then we moved to Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, I see.
So, but interesting thing about Tucson is that so many people move there from the Midwest. It's really pretty much Midwest West.
Got it.
In terms of, you know, lifestyle and beliefs and the whole attitude, I guess you'd say.
So you're
Midwestern in nature.
Right. So your Catholic, devout Catholic upbringing continued after your family moved to Tucson, is that right?
Oh yes. I went through 8 years of Catholic grade school, Catholic high school, then I went to college, and then I taught in a Catholic college for 4 years.
Wow. So you went to a Catholic college too?
No, I did not go to Catholic college.
Oh, okay.
I went to the University of Arizona
okay.
in Tucson. which is just a state college, a very big one. And then I went to Washington University in St. Louis.
Oh,
which,
okay.
Is in theory non-denominational, but has a large Jewish population there. So.
Got it.
Not Catholic, though. Neither one of those were Catholic.
And what did you study in college, just briefly?
When I was in college, I was kind of flipping back and forth between psychology and math. Ended up with a major in psychology and a minor in math and biology. So I really loved science and went on to get my PhD in basically brain research and gerontology through the physiological psychology department in Washington University.
I see. So, but tell us again about your devout Catholic upbringing and what.
Well, let's see. As a little girl, I had a little altar to Mother Mary, and I used to pray the rosary all the time. And as I got older, I'd go to Mass almost every day, sometimes twice a day, and, you know, was a member of the altar guild and did all those kinds of things. But what I remember most was that I really felt there was something there that I couldn't get to. And I felt for years that I was like banging on the gates. Let me in, I know you're there. Just, you know, the Catholic Church wasn't getting me there. And, but in some ways, I'm sure that was a discipline. It was probably karma and all sorts of other things. But, when I moved to Berkeley, after I got married, we both moved to Berkeley. My husband was getting his degree at UC Berkeley. And I got introduced to psychic healing work. And the other thing that I was very devoted to my whole life was healing work. I really wanted to be something, you know, I loved hospitals. I loved everything medical. And when I found the psychic healing work, it was like, wow, that's what I've been looking for.
Was that through the Berkeley?
It had the energy. You know, I could really feel the energy enormously. And there were so many tools, and they were enormously helpful.
Was that through the Berkeley Psychic Institute?
No, but you know, the Berkeley Psychic Institute was certainly the foundation for most of the other schools. There were about 8 or 10 schools in Berkeley, in the Berkeley area at that time. And all of them had people who had graduated from the Berkeley Psychic Institute and then gone on to start their own school. And I went to a school called Heartfelt.
So the tools that that you learned and the energy work that you learned would be familiar to someone familiar with the Berkeley Psychic Institute?
For the most part. The one thing I liked about Heart Song that was different than all the other schools is they worked with heart energy,
mm-hmm.
and the other schools believed that heart energy was, what is the word, manipulative. It could be manipulative, and so they chose not to do that.
So how old were you when you encountered this Heart Song group? And
38. I was 38.
Okay, but we've gotten a little beyond the story. I still want to get back to youth, and because you were talking about that, and you were talking about having a sense of reaching for something, but not penetrating whatever obstacles, whatever
right.
it was you were searching for.
Well, I think there was once when I was in college, I was at some church praying one day, and I had the slightest sense of what at the time I thought of as grace. But now I would describe it as energy or kundalini or something. But it was very faint, but it was like, yes, this is what I'm looking for. And so it was because of that and one other experience that I recognized it when I had my introduction to the psychic work.
When you say that this is what you were looking for, can you describe what the quality was, or what was the effect of this experience that seemed to be such a strong yes for you?
You mean when I was in the psychic school?
No, in the church.
Yeah, oh, in the church.
The moment of grace that you did.
How can I describe it? Well, you know, rain comes in different quality levels. You've got the kind of misty stuff. That was kind of how much it was. It wasn't a downpour. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a big storm. It was just this little misty thing that I could feel it. I was getting the experience of it. And it was definitely what I was looking for, which I hadn't found previously.
Well, I mean, I get the intensity level, and if you'd lived your life in a drought, then even a mist is going to really stand out for you. But yeah. I'm still curious if you can say a little bit more about what it was, and I get that it was a eureka moment kind of for you. Is there anything else you can say about this experience and your response to the experience that would sort of give listeners a sense of what was
It literally was like mist in terms of, but it was like light and not water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was that much intensity, like a mist, and it was certainly something discernible, and it felt really wonderful, but I knew it could be a lot more.
So when
it
you
was
say,
like something, but where, you know, there should be more.
When you say it felt wonderful, I mean, was it a good feeling, a sense of peacefulness, a sense of clarity, or what were the qualities?
I'd say peaceful, perhaps, but, you know, that was a long time ago, and it felt like a sense of grace. And not that I have a definition of what grace feels like more than what I've described, but that was how I interpreted it.
Got it. So during this time, when you're going to church, you've had this experience, you're also at the same time pursuing a career in a scientifically oriented discipline. Is that right?
Right, yes.
So I'm interested in how you balance the scientific worldview.
Well, see, I went to my whole family was very science oriented, and the Catholic Church is fundamentalist in some ways, but it doesn't actually ever suggest that there's anything wrong with science.
Right.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, truth is truth, and I believe that God is truth, and I believe that what we've explored in terms of science is an approximation of truth anyway. I mean, I think most scientists would say that they're always striving to know the depth of what they're studying more deeply, and they're finding out they thought that was right, but now they see that, you know, if you've studied even medicine, but if you've studied physics or anything, you know that there's many conflicting ideas on what, but also constant evolution in what their understanding is.
Right. So if I were to understand what you're saying, it's that you resonated with the scientific method in the sense that there's an objective inquiry into what's true and a willingness to take the facts of direct experience and modify one's conclusions based off of that.
Well, yes and no. As one of my professors would have pointed out to you on something that he didn't like during my oral exam, is I also believe that there's, and even at that time, before I had any of these other training, that you could have an intuitive knowing about things, and that was a worthwhile method of exploring science or anything. It turns out that in psychology, the early main, you know, founders of psychology were kind of split up the middle on that subject. And at some point, psychology went all the way over to one side. But in the early days, there was both the intuitive approach to understanding the mind, as well as the scientific approach. So I had an instinctive tendency to go with both. And wasn't always well received.
Were the proponents of the intuitive version the folks like Carl Jung or William James?
William James, I think, would be the earlier version.
Yeah.
But yeah, Carl Jung was beyond intuitive, I'd say.
Was there anyone else that whose work you would point to that people might know of?
In the
field of psychology early on, who would be advocates for the value of the intuitive?
There probably is, but that information came from my first course in the history of psychology, which I did when I was 20. So I can't really remember.
Okay, that's fine. It's not a problem. I'm just trying to see what the influences were
That was just a very charismatic teacher who brought that up. And then later when I started exploring more deeply, I thought, okay, you know, it was there in the beginning, and then it got shuffled off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, an awareness. It wasn't like a big, oh, look at that.
There. Right, but even an intuitive point of view is if one receives or draws conclusions based off of a deep intuition, isn't there still the expectation that the conclusion would be sort of verifiable in experience, that there's still some...
Or from some kind of data.
Right. There's still some basis of...
Absolutely. Absolutely. I use a number of intuitive tools, and the reason I use them is because they usually work. You know, it's like if I follow my intuition, I'm usually pleased, even though it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't follow it, I'm usually very annoyed with myself. So, yes, there is, you know, if you followed your intuition and it blew up in your face every time, most people wouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, and I think that the distinction I'm just trying to draw is that, particularly in some elements of spiritual practice, people, and certainly this is true in religion, people will make truth claims, and the truth claims aren't necessarily substantiated. They may be based off of what someone's told them, or maybe based off of a fear of the alternative. But there's lots of truth claims that are made that aren't necessarily grounded in either direct experience or even the direct experience of a deep intuition. And that's the distinction I'm really trying to draw out here.
The Catholic Church certainly has a history of people exploring deeply philosophically and trying to understand things. And my experience now, having gone through what I call many levels of consciousness, is that some of these people knew what they were talking about because they had expanded their consciousness, and others of them were kind of stuck in the mental level and were trying to interpret cosmic principles based on rational thinking, and it wasn't getting them
right
where they thought they were going.
Well,
so that's one of my pet peeves.
Got it. Well, I was just coincidentally listening to an interview, a radio interview with Hilary Mantel, the author of several novels about the time of Henry VIII, and and of course there was this was a time when the Church of England was established in opposition to the Catholic Church.
Oh, right.
And so, Ms. Mantel made an interesting comment. She said she's English, and she had been raised as a Roman Catholic in England, and she said, but you know, I was raised as a I can't remember the exact term she used, but basically it was the idea that this was a non-intellectual view. It was actually, she said, the reason that she could write the novels she wrote about this time of Henry VIII is that the version of Catholicism that she was exposed to was kind of medieval in character.
Oh, interesting.
Very, very non-intellectual. Very, you know.
Very faith-based.
Yeah. So I guess. Maybe not just faith-based, but she did. I don't think she used the word superstition, but that was almost the direction she was going.
Well, there certainly in medieval times there was quite a bit of, I guess you'd call, they were selling
indulgences.
Indulgences, yes, thank you. And a lot of the religious teachers were not necessarily as clear and as pure as one would hope in one's religious teachers.
Sure, but the reason I bring this up is because I wanted to inquire about your own exposure to Catholicism, because here's Hilary Mantel, you know, in the 21st century, mentioning that sometime in, I guess, the second half of the 20th century, she's exposed to a very non-intellectual view of Catholicism. You've said that your family were devoutly, at least your mother was devoutly Catholic, but your family were scientifically oriented. So what was that like? What was your experience of that form of faith?
It never seemed to be a conflict at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, we were just steeped in being Catholic, and that's how it was. And then we liked math and science. And from the time I was a little girl, my brother was a couple of years older than I was, and he was quite brilliant, and he was teaching me logic from the time I was about 4.
Hmm. Well,
so, you know, and he was into chemistry, and we were doing all that stuff, so...
So your experience of
Catholicism... was what it was.
Yeah,
and
but...
And I had
but
great
your...
teachers, really. They weren't...
Mm-hmm.
I can only say that I was either lucky or blessed. Because I've heard so many stories of people's experience in Catholic schools that were not happy ones. And I just thought I had wonderful teachers, brilliant and really spiritual, as well as clear thinking. So I didn't have those kinds of problems.
And so when you say spiritual in reference to these teachers, do you mean that they had a heart understanding as well as an intellectual understanding? Or something even more
than
that?
I meant they were dedicated to doing the best they could, to being the best they could be, based on certain, what you could call Christian principles.
Okay.
So as we move forward and you are pursuing a career, I guess it was primarily psychology was the area that you focused on, is that correct?
It is, yes. I was going to college at a time when women weren't considered fodder for the medical school, and I tried nursing and did not find it to my taste, and I probably would have been a good doctor, but it didn't happen. I was just sort of directed elsewhere, so mm-hmm. I found a lot of good things that I was interested in psychology, so I was happy there.
So were you working in research, or was it a clinical program?
I was in research, yes. I was doing different kinds of brain research, basically, and my dissertation was about brain research related to aging and immunology and cognitive function.
That's interesting, because these days that field often is highly characterized by people who have the perspective that every aspect of our consciousness and being is grounded in the functioning of the brain. So I'm wondering, did you experience that, or was there in what you were doing room for maybe?
You know,
I
picked psychology originally because I figured they knew almost nothing, and there'd be lots of room for research.
that makes sense.
You know, they've learned a lot since then, but at the time, it was very, I guess you could say, foundational stuff, beginning stuff.
Yeah.
What they know now is a great deal more. And, of course, there's still a lot we don't know, endlessly, it seems.
Yeah.
But, we're just doing, like, basic stuff, if you put electrodes in the brain here, then the, you know, the rat or the person or the whatever it was responds this way, and if you do that, it does that.
Got it. You're listening to the Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week, our guest by telephone is Michaela Cordio, Ph.D., author of Live and Love, a Life Handbook of the New Golden Age. Her life has been a varied journey, including a devout Catholic upbringing and later a career in science. After a midlife crisis, Michaela gave up her previous career. Today, she describes herself as a mystic, a channel for the ascended hosts of light, a messenger for Father, Mother, God, an author, a spiritual traveler, an ascension teacher, and as a healer, both personal and planetary, a mother and a grandmother. So, in the bio, you mention a midlife crisis, and I'm interested how in this work, in your psychological work, and this yearning for a connection with a deeper sense of spirit, how did these combine to and lead to a crisis, and what was the crisis?
Well, how can I describe it? I had been studying megavitamin therapy with a friend, and we had been finding that using large doses of different vitamins were making a huge difference in our health and our family's health. And I was prepared at that time to quit my job and go back and study that field. And I had this insight. It was kind of an amazing insight. It may not, didn't, you know, it was one of those aha moments that seemed so obvious at the time, but how come I didn't think of it before? I had, a lot of my background in psychology was in behaviorism, which is, you know, positive and negative reinforcement. And University of Arizona had a really big program in behavioral psychology. And I had always motivated myself pretty much by stressing myself out and pushing myself. And I had this insight that I could motivate myself with positive things. It was like, what a surprise. I mean, it was really a huge moment, and it seems like a very obvious moment. But anyway, that was the point at which I decided to quit my job and go more deeply into this alternative healing modality.
Let me just jump in for a second. So the negativity, the negative motivation was stuff
self-delivered, yes.
I'm sorry, say it again?
Self-delivered.
Yeah, but I mean,
I
self-delivered because
a lot of stress.
Yeah, you probably received a lot of reinforcement for that. That, of course, I'm presuming in your career, or am I wrong?
Oh, well, you're talking to the person who had a wonderful opportunity to design and teach in a master's program in gerontology. I created a whole gerontology program from scratch in Oakland at Holy Names College. And at the same time, I had twins and then another baby 2 years later, and I was finishing my PhD. Hmm. So I was really in overwhelm.
Maxed out. And then some, it sounds like.
And it was, so I had three babies under two, basically, while I was doing all this. And I had known for years that I worked very well under stress. If I had the flu, I could write my papers better than if I was well.
Wow.
I know, but
there
I knew
are a lot of people
myself,
who would
kind of
envy you.
On through this. Yes, and, you know, and basically while I was finishing up my degree, my whole immune system broke down, and I was just living on antihistamines, and, you know, there's some that make you sleepy and some that makes you jittery, so I use the jittery ones in the daytime and the sleepy ones at night, and it's kind of working. But the result of that was kind of my immune system was very unhappy, and I got right on the edge of a nervous breakdown. So that's kind of where my life started turning the corner.
I see. So, so you gave up your career in
I did
at Holy Names College.
Well, I did that, and I was home for a while resting, and then I actually worked for 4 years. I was a planner for the Department on Aging in Alameda County, and we had a wonderful team, and we were doing great work, kind of distributing federal money around the county to help seniors, you know, have the kind of social programs they needed. Mm-hmm. And that was when I realized that a lot of seniors didn't really know what they needed. You know, it seemed obvious to anybody that if a person wasn't walking well or they couldn't drive anymore, that they'd need help with their shopping. But it's something that had never been available to people in the past, so they didn't even know to ask for it. So we were trying to design programs to make them available to people that didn't know that they could ask for things that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's very obvious. You know, there's lots of programs for seniors, but at the time, that wasn't the case.
Right.
Got it.
So you were at the Creative Edge there, too, also as well as in the gerontology program.
That was true. And I'm totally grateful to the woman who... the nun who was in charge of the education department, because we ran the whole program through the education department, which was probably the only one in the country that was being run through an education department. But it made perfect sense to us, and the way we did it was, I was very proud of it. It was a great program, and we had a wonderful time.
And so after 4 years of that work, what happened?
Well, after the teaching, then I took 2 years off with my kids and to regenerate my body, and then I was working for the county for 4 years, and then that was when I quit and went into the psychic healing and psychic.
So the midlife crisis then was kind of a rolling crisis over a period of years, if you will.
Yes, right.
And so I'm interested then, you know, you said that you were 38 when you began to be involved in the psychic healing work and being introduced to these tools. It's interesting partly because that's a somewhat older age than a lot of people encounter that work.
Well, at the time, I think, let's see, even the Berkeley Psychic Institute hadn't been around very long. And it was new to just about everybody,
mm-hmm.
even then. So it just how it worked out. But, you know, because I was raised Catholic, part of what my mother believed was that psychic work was the work of the devil.
Right.
So that was a big deal for me to even step into that. And I give full... thanks to a divine intervention on that one. I actually had a live-in babysitter who was going to psychic school, and she invited me to her open house at her psychic school one day. That was Heartsong. And I realized that there wasn't any nice way to say no.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's okay for you to take care of my children, but I think you do the work of the devil. You know, that was where I was at. And so I thought, well, you know, I don't want to lose my babysitter here. I better do something about this. And so I went, and I was, like, shocked would be the word. I mean, it was just a total... It reminded me that the first day I took my twins to the two-year-old preschool, and all three of us were, like, plastered up against the wall, looking at all the action everywhere. I was just sitting there staring at it in shock. And it was kind of like that for me at the psychic school, at the fair. There are all these people toning and doing things. And I was like, what is this stuff? I had no idea what I'd gotten into. And my friend comes up and she says, well, why don't you get a reading while you're here? And I'm thinking, well, how can I get out of this? And I said, well, how much is it? She says, $5. like, okay, there's no excuses. So I went and had a reading. And one of the things I didn't mention that was a big issue for me, it was part of what got me moving forward, was I had had some kind of brain damage when I was 20. I don't know where it came from or when it happened, but all of a sudden I had, I don't know if memory problems would be the right description of it, but it was like as I was having this conversation with you, all of a sudden everything I was talking about would fall in a hole and I wouldn't be remembering what I was talking about, and we'd have to change the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain words that would just not be there when I was trying to talk to somebody, and I'd have to talk around it and find another word to use. So things like house, car, anything could be the word. It would just be gone. So I know, and you know, there I am studying brain research for obvious reasons. And I knew I had brain damage, and I knew exactly what was going on. Well, when I went for this first psychic reading, the reader looks at me and he says, you know, you've got this funny black energy right over, and he pointed to the side of my head, which is right where your speech center is, and I go, oh, it's like, oh, that's not very good. And he suggested I take the beginning healing class, and I thought, well, that's just like a sales pitch. But I went home and I said to my friend with whom I was going to study mega vitamin therapy, I said, look, we were going to, you know, go back to school and take classes and stuff. So what would you think about taking a class with psychic healing? And she says, I think you were crazy. And then she says, well, you know, it might be interesting. It might make something. I could do something with it. Maybe I could get material for writing a story or something. And so I went. And on the first day, it was like I had stuck my finger in a light socket. It was like the most amazing experience I ever had. And that was when I knew that everything I was looking for came together in one.
So, was the healing modality one in which you get help from other beings to affect the healing?
You know, it wasn't taught that way in the school. We just pulled in energy from the earth, mm-hmm. and energy from the universe, ran it through our body, cleaned out our chakras, and then ran it through our hands and shared it with people. Set your highest intention, and you just... We learned how to feel the energy body in other people, and people who were more naturally clairvoyant than I was were able to see things instantly. Well, I had to work really hard to get through a lot of blocks in order to see clairvoyantly and to hear and so on. But I did, and it was a completely amazing experience. I couldn't understand why anybody would go through any kind of psychotherapy that would take years when they could be doing these techniques that would take hours or days.
So I'm interested in particular your experience that you didn't experience yourself as particularly clairvoyant or sensitive when you began this program. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely not. I was totally shut down.
And obviously, there are people that you encountered who seem to actually have access to these kinds of abilities. So
absolutely. That was a little frustrating for me.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about that you had to kind of work it or work through the blocks, can you describe more what that means? Because it's an interesting question, because a lot of people listening to this who don't have access to those kinds of capacities usually just outbox them, saying, well, that's not me. Whether or not, you know, even if they believe their possibility, but you're just saying something even more provocative, which was you didn't have access and there was a methodology for you to work your way through.
Yes. Well, I have to tell you that my first day of class, I had a little bit of a miracle too. And those kinds of energetic miracles were happening about once a week to somebody in the class. So it was a really amazing time for me. But for me, there were two main exercises we were supposed to do in the first class. The first one was grounding. Are you familiar with that concept?
Yeah, but maybe you can just describe it briefly
okay,
for our listeners.
So as I said, you imagine that energy is coming up through your feet, and you imagine energy is coming from heaven down through the top of your head and down your spine and down through your feet into the earth. Well, then you collect energy as you breathe. Imagine gold light coming in. And we collected them in our pelvic area and then turned it into a golden cord that we dropped through the earth all the way down to the center of the earth. Well, I could not do that exercise. I squished and I pushed them, you know, and it just wasn't working. And finally, I got this tiny little, like a fishing line, kind of went down and went in. And I thought, okay, well, that's something. And then the next part of the exercise is you let the energy come up to the top of your head and then go out the top of your head. Well, I couldn't do that either. And these are like the two basic exercises you had to do for every single thing else you're going to be learning. I couldn't do either one of them. And I came home very excited and very frustrated at the same time. And everyone else had already gone to bed, so I got in bed. And at this point, I don't remember because that was like 30 years ago, but either I was asleep and it happened or I was sitting up thinking. And several people appeared to me. And they said, we're going to teach you how to do this right. And I go, like, okay, I have to do this, you know. It's like, here's my life working. I can't do anything. And all of a sudden, it was like, I think they opened up my kundalini, and the kundalini went shooting up my spine to the top of my head, which was totally shut down. And I thought it would kill me, literally. I did. And I said, well, okay, I've been married, I had a career, I have children, I've kind of had a life. If it kills me, that'd be too bad, but, you know, I've got to do this. So it kind of went crashing through the top of my head, and that was like, oh, geez, that was really, you know, painful on top of everything else. But, you know, I think it has something to do with the brain damage, but there's no proof on any of these things. So anyway, then I, like, fell asleep. I was totally exhausted, and I had a dream in which I was at the beach with my son, and we were digging in the sand, and we dug quite a deep hole, and all of a sudden at the bottom of this hole, it started caving in on us. And I went, oh, no. I'm like digging my way out as the sides of the walls are caving in. And I suddenly shot out of my body, like going, you know, like a rocket up into the heavens, and that was a little startling. And all of a sudden, I looked down, and I thought, well, maybe I've gone too far. And instantly, I turned around and went shooting back into my body, through my body, and into the earth. And I woke up, and I said, well, that's one way to get grounded. So that was day one for me. That was huge. And different people were having different kinds of experiences. And everything that anybody had that was in a healing nature was totally unique to them. So, you know, I may be the only person in the world that ever had that particular experience.
And did you find after that experience that you had, you know, sort of more access then to doing the basic work, or was it still a matter of engaging in practice?
It took me 6 months of constant practice to be able to ground correctly and consistently. And just about anybody that knew me at the time would tell you that I was not grounded most of the time.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, and, you know, I just worked at it. And then I was probably 3 months into the program when something else happened, and I had a dream, and I'm pretty convinced that what happened was my brain was rewired and brain damage was gone.
Hmm.
So I don't have any proof of any of that except my own personal experience, because I never went to a doctor to say, oh, I think I have brain damage. You know, didn't ever do that. Nobody ever noticed it except me.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought people were kind of oblivious. You know, they're sort of focused on their own thing, and you change the subject, so you change the subject. They don't notice.
Right, so it was never anything that had been previously diagnosed. It was just something that was a feature of your experience which shifted.
Yes, yes. And it was one of those kinds of things that it was a problem that suddenly wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't necessarily notice something that's not there instantly. You might notice it after a week or two. It's like, look at that. That's not there anymore.
Right. I'm curious if you ever drew a conclusion of whether was the brain issue a physiological issue, or was there, as the psychic who gave you the reading said, there was this energetic feature.
And, you know, I actually think I had a small aneurysm.
Hmm.
And the dream I had where I felt like my brain was being rewired felt like the real thing. That, you know, and they know now that different pathways can be created in the brain to reactivate things. So I suppose I was going to say that was what happened. And like I said, no literal proof, but I knew enough about the way the brain worked to feel pretty confident that that's what happened.
Got it.
Yes, there could have been, you know, whatever that energy thing was there. One of the lessons we learned in the healing process is that, you know, if there's damage, I guess would be the right word, some kind of shock to your system. Let's say you're in a car accident. That's a pretty damaging kind of activity. Even if you're not harmed, it's a shock.
Mm-hmm.
And there's layers of the human aura. And sometimes that shock doesn't go very far in, doesn't go all the way into the physical body, but the outer layers have been shocked and they experience the damage of it. So if you have damage in the outer layers of your field and it doesn't get corrected, it will go into the physical at some point. So I don't know.
So
I mean,
there's not a clean separation.
Tell
right.
you what happened.
Right,
so
I
can't tell you details.
Yeah, I got it.
So I want to get back to the response of the part of you that had grown up and experienced something that you described as the sort of mist of grace.
Yeah.
In a Catholic context, were you still a practicing Catholic at the age of 38 when you set off in this new direction?
Well, I'd say yes and no. I had moved to Berkeley at that time and somewhat backed away from the church. And when my children were born, I felt like I needed to kind of reactivate it. But in the past, I'd had the opportunity to be with really inspirational priests.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't find that in Berkeley. It was very disappointing. And I just, like, it was a struggle to stay with the church in Berkeley.
So in that sense, you were already, by the time you were 38, you were already sort of
pulling away somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely the Catholic way of looking at it. But maybe another way also would be just finding less nutrition, if you will. Metaphor.
Well, I had a very interesting experience because I didn't particularly care for the minister at the church I went to. But after I started all this psychic exploration, I went to him and told him what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't expect much from him, but I got an excellent answer.
Hmm.
And he said, there comes a time in everyone's spiritual development when you have to move beyond the boundaries of organized religion.
Hmm. That is.
But be careful.
Yeah.
You know, and he basically said, he says, there's real evil out there. Be careful. And that was it. And, you know, it was like, thank you. That was what I needed to hear. And you know, at the time when I was involved in the psychic healing classes, I met this man and did some kind of healing practice, and I think he was a Buddhist of some kind, and he said, well, you know, psychic work is, I didn't say temptation, but it was like that, you know, it can be
seductive.
Seductive, yes, but pulling you off the real spiritual path, basically, was what he was saying. And I thought, well, yes, it's probably true, but this is what got me on it.
So,
you know, so, and it's not the only thing I've ever done, but at the time, it was exactly what I needed, and I valued it very much.
Got it. I'm going to ask you to explore. We only have a few minutes before we go for our break at the hour, but mm-hmm. You mentioned that this priest you went to said, it's important to explore outside organized religion, and there's real evil out there. Be careful. Have you mm-hmm. in your work since then? Would you confirm the view expressed by this person that there is real evil out there and you have to be careful?
Yes.
Okay.
I would. And I know there's many thoughts on the subject, and there's some wonderful people who manage to not have anything to do with evil, and I wish I knew how they did that. But part of my journey has been to look at it and to find ways of, I don't know if confrontation is the right word, but if it comes to me to be dealt with, then I've been surrounded by people who work with me that we have the tools to identify it and to clear it from the planet, because it's enough already.
So you feel like there are manifestations of, if we call it evil, it's energy that certainly is inimical to humankind,
right,
and human evolution.
Absolutely. And I asked one time, I don't remember what the circumstances were, but I was given a definition of evil, and they told me there were two kinds of evil. There was planetary evil, which was what we were only supposed to be dealing with on Earth. Planetary evil was when you look at your neighbor's yard or wife or dog and say, I want that, and you go ahead and take it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of wars based on just that
phenomenon.
But cosmic evil was described to me as the act of destruction of that which is good. And we were apparently not supposed to have to deal with that, but we did anyway.
Are you saying, when you say we, do you mean that in general, like the human race wasn't supposed to have to deal with
it?
But
the planet. Yeah.
I see. And so certainly there is the examples of wars and covetousness and fear and contraction that we see in the world around us that certainly seems to fall under the category of planetary evil. So are there examples that... this model,
I think you could throw Hitler in that category, Stalin, Idi Amin.
As a cosmic evil?
As an act of destruction of that which is good, yes.
I see. So basically some of the real foci of destructive energy that we see in history that have a strange way of getting a lot of people to agree with them might be something more than just a basic planetary evil.
Absolutely.
So, but there are surely degrees of this. I mean, people.
Certainly.
I'm a little unclear about the distinction between the cosmic and the planetary on that score. Can you draw that out a bit?
The planetary evil is kind of, I want what you've got, and I'll do what it takes to get it.
It's basic selfishness.
Selfishness, and the extreme and the ignoring of anybody else's feelings or rights to have anything.
Right.
But the other evil, just, if they had to clear cut the planet, that would be fine with them.
So it's sort of destruction for the sake of destruction.
Yes.
Got it. Well, we will come back to this topic after the break, but... we have to take a short break at the hour. The time is 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. You're listening to KOWS-LP Cows Radio. Broadcasting live from Occidental California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week, Co-host Rob Schmidt and I have our guest by telephone, Michaela Cordio, Ph.D., author of Live and Love, a Life Handbook for the New Golden Age. Her life has been a varied journey, including a devout Catholic upbringing and later a career in science. After a midlife crisis, Michaela gave up her previous career. Today she describes herself as a mystic, a channel for the ascended hosts of light, a messenger for Mother, Father, God, an author, a spiritual traveler, an ascension teacher, a healer, both personal and planetary, a mother, and a grandmother. So stay tuned for more of this discussion after our break. Cowes Community Radio thanks West County Herb Company for their support. West County Herb Company provides locally grown organic herbs, soaps, lotions, salves, tinctures, and medicine-making supplies. You can visit their store here in Occidental. It's just half a block north of Howard's Restaurant. Cowes Community Radio thanks our neighbor hardware store, Occidental Hardware, for their support of community radio. From building materials to office supplies, Occidental Hardware, we got the stuff. Visit them at the corner of Hill Street and Bohemian Highway here in Occidental. You can reach them by phone at 707-874-3441 or find them on Facebook at facebook.com/OCHHardware, O-C-C-H-D-W-E. The Western Sonoma County Historical Society in Sebastopol operates West County Museum and the Luther Burbank Experimental Farm. The museum's new exhibit opens March 19th, Sebastopol Vogue, High Fashion of the 19th and 20th Centuries, and runs through April 20th. Clothing displays include 1890s ball gowns, World War I era walking dresses, and 1920s jazz age flapper dresses. The museum is open Thursdays through Sundays, 1 to 4 p.m., free admission. That's West County Museum, 261 South Main Street, Sebastopol. Cowes Community Radio is membership supported, and though everyone works here on a volunteer basis, we have real operating costs to keep community radio on the air. We have an ambitious program to move our antenna to the east so that we can have better coverage in downtown Sebastopol and increase our listenership. And to help support this event, we have a fundraiser happening at the Hop Monk on May 3rd. This is the More Cowbells Ball. That's Sunday, May 3rd, $25 donation required in order to help Cowes Community Radio and community radio in general. The event goes from noon to 10:30 p.m. There's going to be a long day of music with Dylan Chambers, Midnight Transit, Ricky Ray Band, Stylites on stage, Julie Lemon, Captain Paisley, Lester Chambers, Mud Stompers, Levi Lloyd, and the list goes on and on. There'll be raffles, silent auctions, and basically a lot of fun. That's the More Cowbells Ball, Sunday, May 3rd at Hop Monk, noon to 10:30 p.m. Every ticket helps increase our signal with a better-placed antenna. So we hope to see you there and hope to have you become a member of the herd and support community radio.
And you can find out when you're there about other ways that you can help support Cowes and even become a programmer on Cowes. If you have an ambition to do something like that, we're locally created and locally supported, so that's another way to support and be part of the herd. So we'll return to our conversation with Michaela Cordio after a short musical break. You'll be listening to Carolyn's Farewell, a piece by O'Carolyn, from born 1670, died 1738, from the CD The Celtic Viol, an homage to the Irish and Scottish musical traditions, music of which is performed by Jordi Savall on treble viols and Andrew Lawrence King on Irish harp and psalterium.